Active History is pleased to present a recording of Bill Weiser's talk, "Our Country is No Longer Able to Support Us." The talk was delivered as part of the Other 60s, the decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto.
Our country is no longer able to support us. As we heard earlier today, Canadian territorial expansion to the Northwest was a planned feature of the 1867 Confederation deal. Indeed, no sooner had Confederation become a reality than the Canadian negotiators sat down in London over the winter of 1868-1869 to discuss the Dominion acquisition of Rupert's Land. But the tendency to focus on this real estate transaction and the subsequent Red River resistance overlooks the fundamental change that was occurring in the Western Interior in the 1860s, that instability and change were not something restricted to Canada, and that Indigenous peoples of the region, in particular the Plains Cree, sought a long-lasting reciprocal arrangement with the new Dominion of Canada. So just as Confederation produced a new political arrangement in British North America, the Plains Cree of the Northwest were seeking a new relationship with Canada in response to new circumstances. Bison numbers were already in steep decline by the mid-19th century, but the drier climate of the 1850s had not only reduced the carrying capacity of the northern plains, but kept herds from coming north for winter shelter. A decade later, bison were generally to be found only in Blackfoot country, only in southwestern Alberta, and out of reach of bands along the Saskatchewan River. The Cree, Assiniboine, Soto, and even some Métis responded by joining together in large hunting parties that entered enemy country or Blackfoot country in force. This Cree-Blackfoot warfare had been one of the defining features of intertribal relations on the Northern Plains since the early 20th century. But whereas it once been over access to horses and trade goods, the fighting by the mid-19th century was increasingly over the steadily diminishing bison herds. Now, it's been estimated that the Northern Plains of the Western Interior likely supported from 5 to 6 million bison in the early 20th century. But by the 1860s, two-thirds of the animals were gone. Or as a Methodist missionary, George McDougall, gloomily summed up the situation along the North Saskatchewan River, a time of starvation, no buffalo. So just as Métis hunting caravans from Red River had to travel greater distances to the south and west, so did the Cree, Assiniboine, and Salto to find enough animals to meet their needs. They went to Wood Mountain, the Cypress Hills, including present-day northern Montana. The hunt increasingly took them into Blackfoot territory. Given their numbers, there were both war parties that hunted bison and buffalo hunters traveling as armies. These were also anxious times for the Indians, made worse by smallpox, another epidemic in 1869-1870, when the disease spread north from the Missouri country, first to the Blackfoot and then to the Cree. The death toll from this latest smallpox epidemic may have ranged from 15% to 40%. That smallpox never reached the Red River settlement was a blessing. But because much of Canada's attention was focused on the Métis resistance and the delay in the transfer, this epidemic has been largely ignored, if it was known about at the time. So, too, was one of the largest battles in Plains Indian warfare. October 1870, the Cree and the Blackfoot fought at the junction of the Belly or the Old Man and St. Mary Rivers near present-day Lethbridge. Several hundred dead in this battle. And as I said, it's the largest campaign in Plains Indian warfare. The following spring, the Cree sent the Blackfoot tobacco, and a peace agreement was later reached at a meeting at the Red Deer River. But things are not great. Starvation followed. The Cree, who wintered along the North Saskatchewan in search of bison, quote, had suffered frightfully, and according to one fur trader, had been reduced to eating their horses. Then in 1870, they learned that the Canadian government had bought their lands from the Hudson's Bay Company. Newcomers meant more competition for the dwindling bison resource. So Chief Sweetgrass, the leading chief in the Fort Pitt District, sent a message to the Lieutenant Governor of the Northwest Territories. Great Father, I shake hands with you and bid you welcome. We heard our lands were sold and we did not like it. Our country is no longer able to support us. We invite you to come and speak to us. But no one came. No one came because the Canadian government was not prepared to sign treaties with Indians beyond Manitoba. And so the Cree took matters into their own hands. They stopped the survey party. They stopped the Geological Survey of Canada party. In fact, they made it very clear to Dr. Robert Bell that he was a trespasser in their territory and that Canadian government would have to treat with them. Ottawa had no choice. I don't want to go into the details of Treaty 6 today. Here it is in the middle of present-day Saskatchewan, Alberta, and this territory here. But I want to emphasize a few things with regard to the bison. First of all, in seeking a treaty, the Cree were trying to follow up on the example they had with the Hudson's Bay Company. When they met with the Hudson's Bay Company on an annual basis, they had a pre-trading ceremony. In other words, the trade relationship was constantly renewed. That's what they expected at Treaty 6. At Treaty 6, a territory that included 120,000 square miles, the Cree were deadly serious about these negotiations. They showed up with their own translator, Peter Erasmus. In fact, he was so good that the Canadian government hired him for their side during the negotiations. Finally, this agreement at Fort Carleton was done in a spirit of spirituality. There was the sacred pipe stem ceremony. Alexander Morris, the commissioner at the time, thought it was rather quaint, but the Cree undertook this pipe stem ceremony to ensure that negotiations were done in the presence of the Creator. This is a sketch of Fort Carleton. In fact, the treaty negotiations were nearby on a hill, and they're right now excavating that site because there were several hundred people camped there. What happened during the treaty negotiations is that the Canadian government, through Alexander Morris, presented what was being offered. The Cree caucused, and we know that because of Peter Erasmus. The next day, when negotiations resumed, Poundmaker stepped forward and stated that while his people were anxious to make a living for themselves, he wanted assurances that they would receive adequate help when needed. Morris misunderstood him. He thought the Cree were asking to be fed every day. When Morris countered that the Cree had to trust the Queen's generosity, Mr. Wasses replied, and I quote, "It is in the case of any extremity. This is not a trivial matter for us." And so the famine clause was part of Treaty 6. In fact, what should be emphasized about Treaty 6 is that Morris promised the Cree that the Queen would keep, quote, "a watchful eye and sympathetic hand over them." He constantly made references to family and kin. These were not empty words to the Cree, who valued the spoken word. They fully expected and looked forward to a beneficial, meaningful relationship with the Crown. Other Cree leaders at other Treaty 6 negotiations were also worried about bison protection. When Commissioner Morris met the Willow Cree near Duck Lake in late August 1876, much of the discussion dealt with the disappearance of the bison. "I'm alarmed when I look at the buffalo," one counselor told Morris. "It appears to me as if there is only one." Concern about the bison was also raised at Fort Pitt that September, 1876. Remember, Sweetgrass asked to meet with the Lieutenant Governor in 1871? It took 5 years for a representative to show up. And when that representative showed up, what Sweetgrass asked was, and I quote, "I want my brother to commence to act for me, that the buffalo be protected. We will commence hand in hand to protect the buffalo." At that meeting, there was Big Bear. He was not a signatory to Treaty 6 because he wanted to see whether the government would keep its word. And he also believed that the government was not promising enough. But what's also interesting is that Big Bear also asked that bison be protected. After Treaty 6, Morris reflected on the meetings, and he said that the food question was the turning point, his words, the turning point of the treaty. Quote, "They saw the buffalo, the only means of their support, passing away, and they dreaded that during the transition period, they would be kept swept off by disease and famine." He also informed the government, and quote, "The subject of bison protection was constantly pressed on my attention by the Indians," and he promised that the matter would be considered by the Northwest Territories Council. He kept his word. Action on bison preservation was taken at the first and only meeting of the Northwest Territories Council held at Livingston, Northwest Territories in March 1867. They held only one meeting there because Fort Livingston was built near a garter snake hibernaculum. And the snakes constantly got into everything. And so they moved the capital to Battleford. But while they were meeting at Fort Livingston, they did pass an ordinance for the protection of bison. And it's often hailed as one of the first pieces of Canadian environmental protection. But what's interesting is that the regulations upset the Indian population, the very people that were asking for bison protection, because these regulations banned traditional procurement activities. They could no longer hunt by the pound. They could no longer use bison jumps. So the legislation contradicted what they wanted to do. It also forbid the killing of any bison under 2 years of age. And I don't know how if you can tell if a bison is 2 years or younger, but that was also a feature of this legislation. It was also unclear how it was going to be enforced and who was going to enforce it. It didn't matter. In 1879, the bison disappeared from the Northern Plains, 10 years earlier than most people expected. At first, the Canadian government was happy about bison protection. They didn't want to feed the Cree. In fact, they encouraged the Cree to travel south across the 49th parallel and hunt there. But the Cree, while they're in the United States, were getting into trouble. And Ottawa also worried about an international incident. And so by the early 1880s, federal politicians began to blame the Indian failure to settle down the reserves and become successful farmers because of the bison hunt. And so in the end, by the early 1880s, they were glad the bison disappeared. This is what Prime Minister Macdonald said in the House of Commons. "The utter disappearance of the bison is not a bad thing. I am not at all sorry. So long as there was hope that the bison would come into the country, there was no means of inducing the Indians to settle down on their reserves." In other words, the bison hunt was incompatible with civilizing the Indian and had no place in the new modern society destined to take shape and flourish on the Northern Plains. Those in the House of Commons did not take issue with Macdonald's argument. In fact, the Liberal opposition wondered why he was spending money on a dying race. It's often overlooked that the Liberals were more hard-assed than the Conservatives. As for the Cree, they were prepared to accept the Queen's hand because it was understood from Morris's repeated assurances that the Queen or her representatives could be counted upon to assist the Indians. Unlike any long-term relationships, the Indians expected that it would be constantly renewed. The promises that Morris made were not just words to the Cree participants. They fully expected and looked forward to a beneficial and meaningful relationship with the Crown. In fact, one scholar has suggested in a comprehensive history of treaty making in Canada that Treaty 6 should be seen as a covenant between the Crown and the Cree participants. But in making promises and talking about a long-term reciprocal agreement in the summer of 1876, the Crown representatives did not tell the Cree that the Canadian government had passed the Indian Act earlier that spring, April 1876. The Treaty 6 meeting, August, September 1876, they passed the Indian Act April 1876. This federal statute effectively defined Indians as wards of the state, subject to a number of interfering and coercive measures. Empire building and colonialism became the order of the day in direct opposition to the spirit and intent of Treaty 6 and the expectations of the Plains Cree. Indian leaders, it needs repeating, were unaware of the Indian Act at the time of the treaty negotiations and did not know that the Act would come to regulate their lives once the treaty had been signed as dependents, not equals. When the federal government subsequently failed to meet its treaty obligations, preferring to deal with the Indians as administered peoples under the Indian Act, it led to resentment among Indian bands and a concerted, though peaceful, campaign to secure better support and assistance in keeping with treaty promises. Unfortunately, Chief Sweetgrass would not be part of that diplomatic initiative. 6 months later, after the signing of Treaty 6, he was accidentally killed by the gun that had been given to him as a treaty present. Thank you.
You have been listening to a recording of Bill Weiser's talk, "Our Country is No Longer Able to Support Us." The talk was delivered on April 22, 2017, as part of the Other 60s, a decade that shaped Canada and the world, a symposium hosted by the Department of History at the University of Toronto. You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca, and be sure to subscribe to the History Chats podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.